I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Tortoise. Hello, it's Claudia, and you're listening to the Slow Newscast from Tortoise.
I'm on them. Come on, you.
Boeing ruled the skies.
Fighters, 10 o'clock.
Watch those 2 and 12, man. They're coming in.
They're coming in, Scotty.
Their planes were so famous during World War II, they're better known by nicknames. They were legends in their own right.
Watch that fighter coming in at 3 o'clock.
He's coming in a half roll.
And now...
Are these planes safe?
You know, it's like an earthquake. You know, the big earthquake is coming.
When all you're focused on is profits, you're likely to kill people in this business.
Nothing they did on the 737 was bad news until after the murder.
Every person stepping aboard a Boeing airplane is at risk.
Somewhere along Boeing's journey, something has gone badly wrong. To try to understand what happened and when, my colleague Giles Whittell tells the story of how Boeing had, and then lost, the American dream.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. This is your captain. Welcome to the jet age.
Boeing.
This aircraft is the 707 Intercontinental. It's the largest jet airliner in the world. Incidentally, the first one of these big jets made its initial flight as the year 1959 began.
Boeing. What a name. Two big syllables, that Teutonic diphthong in the middle, and a hint of bow and arrow. It reminds me of trips to the airport aged six just to see a 707 land. It sounds mad, but I still get a kick out of saying the word. Boeing. It used to be that in American corporate iconography, nothing beat Boeing. Not GM, not GE, certainly not DuPont or Microsoft or Google. Boeing was American can-do in polished aluminium or aluminum. It was ingenuity, ambition, reach, lethality, and the smell of jet fuel. It was up there with NASA, literally.
Once at the pad, night and day, checkout and testing go on until the final countdown starts in the launch control room.
Lead contractor for the Saturn V.
Until the five engines of the first stage ignite.
By that time, Boeing had won the war in Europe, in a manner of speaking.
There's two more diving through the 94th.
Three planes, 9 o'clock, coming around.
And in the Pacific.
At 2:45 in the morning, August 6, 1945, Colonel Tibbetts takes the Enola Gay down the runway into the air, beginning the 6 1/2 hour flight to Japan. Over Iwo Jima, they begin the slow climb to bombing altitude.
Boeing shrank the world with the jumbo.
September 30th, 1968, first giant 747 is presented to the world. This is a milestone in Boeing history, a time to look forward.
It turned one of those 747s into Air Force One. And for the rest of us, it built the 727. And it built the 737.
It was almost the go-to aircraft to go buckets and spades down to Benidorm.
And the 757. Trump has one of them. And the 767, the 777, the 787, and Well, maybe that's it. Maybe that's the end of the line. Last Wednesday, a Boeing engineer turned whistleblower testified on Capitol Hill.
My name is Sam Solifer, and I'm a quality engineer at the Boeing. I have over 40 years of experience as an engineer. I'm not here today because I want to be here. I'm here today because I felt that I must come forward because I do not want to see another 787 or 777 crash.
Next up was Ed Pearson, a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis and a former engineer at Boeing and the Federal Aviation Administration.
The world is shocked to learn about Boeing's current production quality issues. I'm not surprised. Unless action is taken and leaders are held accountable, every person stepping aboard a Boeing airplane is at risk.
Pearson was outraged that no one at Boeing has been sent to jail. But why would anyone at Boeing need to go to jail? You don't have to go that far back for an answer.
Well, we begin with breaking news. The search for wreckage is underway after a passenger jet with 189 people on board crashed. It had just taken off from the Indonesian capital, Jakarta.
The crash of Indonesia's Lion Air flight on the 29th of October 2018 killed all 189 people aboard. It was blamed on a malfunctioning software system called the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, or MCAS. Boeing had fitted it to all its 737 MAX 8 planes, thinking that pilots would seldom even be aware of it. Airlines grounded the plane after the crash, but Boeing didn't fix the MCAS.
Our breaking news, an Ethiopian Airlines flight has crashed shortly after takeoff from Addis Ababa, killing all 157 passengers and crew thought to be on board.
5 months later, another 737 MAX 8 crashed in Ethiopia. For the same reason. Since then, multiple investigations found that there was only one MCAS system per plane, so there was no redundancy. And they found that Boeing had persuaded American officials to let it remove any mention of the system from the pilot's training manual. Boeing's CEO at the time was Dennis Muhlenberg. Someone who worked with him says he was, quote, completely out of his depth, unquote. Even so, Muhlenberg left with a $62 million payoff. How did the company that stood for American competence and power come to this? Well, it's a story of greed and luggage. Let's start with the luggage. That's the sound of a very particular sort of engine.
In the very early days, they were using Pratt & Whitney JT8Ds, if memory serves me correct, small diameter jet engines that would fit under the wings.
Graham Simons is an expert on the 737, and the engine diameter is important because the smaller the diameter, the lower the plane can sit to the ground.
By having the entire airframe low to the ground, you didn't need tall stairs. Passengers could board relatively easy by climbing up 5, 6, 7 steps sooner than 15 or 20 steps. It was quicker to load passengers.
And luggage.
They didn't need lots of fancy, specific, bespoke ground equipment to do all the servicing, to do all the maintenance, to do all the turnaround stuff. It became cost effective.
In his book, Boeing 737, the world's most controversial commercial jetliner, Simons digs out an old Boeing sales document that boasts of a 46-inch clearance between the ground and the cargo doors and, quote, an average minor ground stop time of 13 minutes. That's 13 minutes on the ground if you need to refuel or let off passengers in Boise, Idaho, or Saint-Tropez, which is pretty incredible. So, quick turnaround, any old airport. The 737 sold like crazy.
The sales and the use of the airliner just grew and grew and grew.
Like any bestseller, it went through multiple editions. The 100 series, the 200 series, and so on. Before long, Boeing liked to say there was a 737 taking off or landing somewhere in the world every 30 seconds. This was in the late 70s and early 80s. The jet age, for normal people.
and Airbus wanted a piece of it. By 1984, Airbus was ready to launch a rival to the 737, the A320. If you've flown with EasyJet, you've flown on an A320. Right now, it rules the skies. But it didn't always. In 1988, the year the A320 went into commercial service, one of its earliest deliveries to Air France crashed at an air show in Mulhouse in France. The plane was full of journalists and invited guests. It ploughed into woods at the end of the runway. While the pilot was trying to demonstrate a fancy new fail-safe technology that was supposed to make accidents like this impossible. Boeing didn't use this technology, but there was still a question. How to see off competition from the A320? That question could be distilled as, should they revamp the 737, or should they replace it?
It was a cost decision that has been going on almost since the original 100 series was first developed. It's a lot easier and cheaper to do a modification certification to an existing design than call all these modifications amount to a new aircraft. The moment they start talking in terms of it's a new aircraft, there has to be all the testing done again, all the development work done again, all the design.
Boeing chose revamp over replace. But there was a catch. It turns out that when you're saving money, there almost always is. They were making the 737 bigger, so they needed more power.
Bigger engines, more thrust, more better fuel efficiency, make the whole thing bigger.
But where to put those engines?
They couldn't lengthen the undercarriage legs, because if they did, when the undercarriage gear closed up, it wouldn't do that. To lengthen the undercarriage legs would mean a complete redesign of the entire wing structure. Also, they couldn't move the undercarriage legs outboard, away from the center line of the fuselage, to give them more of a gap. Because the engines were in the way, they couldn't do that.
So instead, they put bigger engines in a new casing that they squashed, so the bottom was still far enough off the ground to be safe.
They put a flat bottom on the bottom of the engines. That's where, if you look at some, well, all of the 737s today, they're all round engines with a flat bit on the bottom, as if they've almost been ground away.
And the 737 kept on selling. In the States, Southwest Airlines grew to become one of the biggest in the country with just one type of aircraft, the 737. Ditto Ryanair in Europe. Low maintenance costs, low fares, happy customers, fat dividends. What could possibly go wrong? Well, fast forward quarter of a century. By this time, the 737 is 45 years old and Boeing has to choose again between revamp and replace, and thereby hangs a tale.
Okay. So my name is Cynthia Cole. I worked at the Boeing Company for 32 years as an engineer, and the first, oh gosh, the majority of my time was as a flight test engineer. It was flight test planning.
Cynthia Cole worked initially in Boeing's military division.
So I worked on all the bombers, all of them, and I worked on some of the fighters, and yeah, in fact, I worked on all the Boeing bombers, and then that was the B-2, the B-52, the B-1, and then the latest one was the P-8A, which is a 737 with a bomb bay for the Navy. So I was into the bombers, and then I worked two different fighter programs. My nickname on the B-2 was Goddess of Flight Test, just so you know.
She also worked on Air Force One.
That project was after 9/11. We had to upgrade the communications suites because the reason everybody saw that the Air Force One kept landing and landing and landing with the president in it is because he couldn't communicate. They didn't have TV, and so he didn't know what was going on in the rest of the country. And his Secretary of State was out of the country at the time. and he was in South America trying to fly home. And so the president's kind of flying blind. Nobody knew what was going on. And so Boeing got an emergency contract to upgrade the communication suites on all these planes.
She loved it. She loved Boeing.
You know, there is only one Boeing in this whole world.
Or at least there was.
A major announcement today in the world of aviation. Boeing and McDonnell Douglas today announced they would join together to form the world's largest aircraft manufacturer.
This is, I believe, an historic moment in aviation and aerospace.
The merger between Boeing and McDonnell Douglas in 1997 was sold to regulators and investors as a marriage. But it wasn't a happy one, as viewers of the comedian John Oliver's late-night chat show found out.
And while Boeing was the acquirer in the partnership, it soon became clear that the McDonnell Douglas culture, which was much more cutthroat and profit-driven, was going to become dominant.
John Oliver went on to show his viewers The Economist's cover from the time of the merger. It was a picture of two camels having sex. The reality, unfortunately, was less friendly.
My building ended up having a McDonnell Douglas guy as the head of everything, and we had a meeting out in a parking lot. It was a really nice day, and he's out there. The guy who was running our program was out there. We're having a big all-hands meeting, and an aircraft takes off from SeaTac, and it's flying overhead because we were in the path.
SeaTac is Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. Boeing's historic headquarters is half an hour up the freeway on the eastern shore of Puget Sound. For years, one of its buildings, where the jumbo was assembled, was the biggest in the world. Cynthia Cull was outside it in the parking lot.
This is right when the meeting was just about to get started, and our manager introduces himself and introduces the McDonnell Douglas guy, and when that manager walks up, because our manager was very, very popular with the engineers. And so when the McDonnell Douglas guy gets up, he looks at the Boeing manager and he says, "And you work for me. Keep that in your mind." It was pretty snarky. This is not Boeing culture to say nasty things like that in front of the workforce.
This is in front of how many engineers?
Oh, there must have been 400 or 500 engineers.
And was it a joke?
No, he was serious. He wanted to make sure that our manager knew his place. And so then this aircraft flies overhead. It's a 747 taking off from SeaTac. The McDonnell Douglas guy looks up in the sky and says, "Oh, it's not one of ours," meaning it wasn't built by McDonnell Douglas. And so that's when engineers started leaving, going back to their desks. The parking lot, it emptied. Almost everybody left because that was so insulting that they didn't want to hear anything else he had to say. So, yeah, that was like the start.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. UK business leaders are quietly confident that better times are coming. More than half of those who responded to the recent EY CEO Outlook survey believe their profitability would increase in 2024. As businesses look to the future, transformation is clearly front and centre on the 2024 CEO agenda. with the vast majority of leaders planning to maintain or accelerate their transformational change in 2024. With 76% of CEOs in agreement that AI will deliver transformative efficiency benefits to their organization, how can AI be put to use to enhance innovation efforts? Find out how integrating AI into your business could minimize the negative impacts on the workforce, boost productivity, and improve overall employee experience by reading the full report at ey.com.
You don't have to be interested in mergers and acquisitions to see that the Boeing-Douglas merger was, in its way, historic.
The high-ups came from McDonnell Douglas that had a much more sales-orientated culture than an engineering culture.
It was a head-on collision between Reaganomics, which was all about money, and unionized Boeing engineering, which was all about planes. One senior source in a position to know, not a trade unionist, says the merger was driven by greed, pure and simple. He says the prime mover was the last CEO of McDonnell Douglas, who became the second CEO of the new Boeing, and who was keen, quote, on getting indecently rich. This was Harry Stonecipher. He was 61 at the time, built like a linebacker, not a man of many words, if few would do. At McDonnell Douglas, he'd found that getting just decently rich was not too hard. All it took was a keen focus on the requirements of the military.
Part of the thing is, McDonnell Douglas got out of the commercial business because the military, you can pull the wool over the eyes of the military and overprice your contracts a whole lot easier than with the commercial realm.
Other people confirm this. They say that the Pentagon tolerates delays, fatalities, and ballooning budgets much more readily than commercial airlines do. They say that the Douglas crew got used to this, that after the merger, engineering at Boeing gave way to financial engineering. That in turn meant big awards of shares for senior executives, it meant share buybacks to boost the value of those shares, cost cutting to increase margins, and quantity over quality. As one worker on a new Boeing production line told an undercover reporter in 2014, we're not building them to fly, we're building them to sell. Know what I mean?
And this takeover just broke my heart.
In practical terms, it had three consequences. The first of these involved offloading risk onto subcontractors and giving them a new name.
They were taking over our culture, and the Joint Strike Fighter was the first place where, oh my gosh, it was where they tried out the vendors and suppliers become partners, the partners model that failed on the 787. Well, it failed first on the Joint Strike Fighter.
Cynthia Cole is talking about the F-35 fighter, the most expensive weapon system ever built.
And the vendor, which became a partner of the fuel system, didn't do their job right, and it wasn't going to work. And so we had enough heritage Boeing engineers still in the program that they saved the Joint Strike Fighter, you know, the Boeing version, and they got the fuel system to work.
The same system, the partner system, was meant to turn the Boeing 787 into a cash cow. This was the Dreamliner, a brand new long-haul jet made of composites with big windows, a bit more room for actual people, improved fuel efficiency, and a huge price tag. Here's Dominic Gates, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Seattle Times, talking to Al Jazeera.
The board made it clear that they wanted this plan made for less money. They wanted it made for $5 billion. They wanted partners to come in to pay the rest.
Those partners included fuselage builders and engine suppliers from Italy to Japan and the UK, and they did come in, and it cost them. In the meantime, Boeing moved.
Boeing's headquarters moved away from the Washington, Seattle, Washington State area to Chicago. It took all the high management, CEOs and all the rest, away from the shop floor to a glass office in Chicago that was remote. They lost sight of what was going on on the shop floor. This all set about a whole series of cost-cutting exercises that led to failure after failure after failure.
That was horrible. That was really horrible. It needed to stay in Seattle. That's where your customers were. That's where everything was. That was the heritage. That means you got hands on the aircraft. And it was, and a lot of the, what people don't know is that that move cost a lot of money. And the original people that were supposed to go refused. So I don't know what happened to them, but a lot of the workforce that was supposed to go to Chicago said, no, not doing it.
Cynthia Cole went to Chicago, though.
And they wouldn't let us in. I got my Boeing badge, and I'm not allowed to walk into that building unless I had a pre-approved visit notice. So we tried it just because we'd heard you couldn't get in, and it was true. You know, I'm an engineer. I test it. You know, I want to see if it was really true. And so we were there, and we couldn't just walk in. So that was an eye-opener, because any other Boeing plant, I could just walk in with my Boeing badge.
It was in 2011, in their glass tower, that Boeing's senior executives had to make that choice again, to revamp or replace their workhorse, the 737. Now remember, replacement meant a whole new airplane, which meant cost. Once again, they chose revamp. An even longer body and even bigger engines, but still no change to the short landing gear and the generally low-slung look of the 737. Because that would be a whole new plane. This time the engines had to be pushed further forward to be raised to give the necessary clearance, which changed how the plane flew, which created the need for the MCAS, that software patch to stop the plane pitching up by pitching it down instead.
The MCAS itself is software that was horridly designed based on no past engineering premise, even the most fundamental principle issues of engineering, and that is it was placed on the airplane with a single point of failure, a single sensor, and then on top of that, it had no limits as to how far it would push the nose down.
Dennis Tager is a 737 pilot with American Airlines and spokesperson for the 16,000 members of the airline's pilots union.
And it had no limits as to how many times it would try to do that. So it was relentless. The only limit it had was until it killed you.
Dennis Tager calls the 737 an Apollo-era capsule trying to be flown and sold in a SpaceX world.
Here's the bottom line. The MAX was designed, put out onto the assembly line to account for the fact that Boeing fell asleep against the competition Airbus. It's no secret. They were shocked when suddenly everybody went to buy Airbus's new Neo model, and they made up an airplane. They said, let's just rehash the MAX. MAX became the symbol of what Boeing became decades in the making after they merged with McDonnell Douglas. It was about getting costs down, driving share price up. This is not a critique on capitalism. This is an affirmation that when all you're focused on is profits, you're likely to kill people in this business.
It wasn't meant to be like this. Boeing was meant to rule the 21st century like it ruled the 20th. And it planned to do so starting on July the 8th, 2007, which, if you write in the American style, comes out as 787.
The airlines with us today have made a big commitment to Boeing and to this airplane. So far, they have ordered 677 of them.
It's launch day for the 787. Pep rally over, the giant doors of an aircraft hangar slide open to reveal what Barack Obama later calls
the plane of the future.
Boeing's plan was to sell hundreds of 787s at about $250 million apiece in today's money. If that had happened, it might have satisfied Boeing's new class of bosses and left money over to replace the 737 with something that stood taller and flew safer. But it didn't happen. On launch day, the 787 wasn't ready, not even close. It was 2 years from being ready. One reporter looked up into the wheel wells and saw daylight. He was not supposed to. Another found that the doors were made of plywood.
We learned that the whole thing was a sham.
The 787's composite fuselage was overweight, according to one key supplier, and the partners tasked with building it were having trouble fitting its component parts together. Here's Graham Simons.
You slide the front section up to the front part of the barrel, you slide the tail section up to the back end of the barrel, and in theory, everything fits. They've had a number of instances where joining these fuselages together, 20 millimetres one side, 20 millimetres the other, either out that way, it fits right at the top and it don't fit at the side, or it fits right at the side and it doesn't fit right top and bottom. They've had to force the fits. In forcing the fits, that's putting stress on it.
You know, airplanes are not IKEA furniture. You can't just press them together and jam in a bolt and say, hey, we're good to go. They're much more complex and intricate. So, I hope Boeing got this right because the consequences are serious. But you see, the benefit of the doubt with Boeing is running extraordinarily thin. As a matter of fact, it's not there. It is a desert when it comes to trust with Boeing.
Boeing denies that there's fatigue anywhere in its 787 airframes. It says carbon fiber doesn't fatigue. That didn't stop Sam Salipur, the engineer-turned-whistleblower, testifying before Congress last week.
Since 2013, there have been serious issues on the 787 program not properly closing thousands of gaps in its assembly of the fuselage on major joints. Boeing's standard says that these gaps must be closed, usually by a small shim or filler called a shim when they exceed 0.005 of an inch. This seems very small. Boeing's PR team like to call it the width of a human hair when you are operating at 35,000 feet. Details are that the size of a human hair can be a matter of a life and death.
Salipur said he'd reported to management that the gaps between 787 fuselage sections weren't being properly measured or shimmed 97.5% of the time.
As a result, I witnessed severe misalignment when the planes were assembled. And this also weakens the airplane in the long run. I literally saw people jumping on the pieces of the airplane to get them to align. I call it the Tarzan effect, among other improper methods. Again, I raised concerns internally. I was sidelined. I was told to shut up. I received physical threats. My boss said, I would have killed someone who said what you said.
No 787 has crashed yet. But the 787 program hasn't funded a replacement for the 737 either. Instead, its failings have only intensified the pressure on the 737 MAX to sustain the entire company's performance. And that is unfortunate, as Ed Pearson, the former FAA and Boeing engineer, told the same congressional committee.
I've done everything I can to continue telling the world the MAX airplane is still unsafe and to alert authorities to Boeing's dangerous manufacturing.
In fairness, Dennis Tager, the American Airlines pilot, says the MCAS problem has, at last, been fixed. Pearson's allegation is a separate one about the sensor, the single sensor, that it depends on. One whistleblower who did not appear before Congress last week was John Barnett. He alleged a series of flaws in quality control at Boeing's giant 787 assembly plant in Charleston, in South Carolina. And he was found dead in his pickup near the plant last month, apparently by his own hand. Asked if he thinks Barnett took his own life, Graham Simons pauses before answering.
No comment. Knowing the Americans, I've been going backwards and forwards to the US since 1980. I've known people in Boeing, I know people in the US military. I know a couple of congressmen. I look at how American politics are working at the minute. Nothing would surprise me.
The truth is, plenty of unimaginable things at Boeing have turned out to be true. For example, it persuaded the Federal Aviation Administration to let it do almost all the certification of its own planes and processes. As we've now seen, it installed the MCAS system on 737s and didn't tell their pilots. And it gave its outgoing CEO, Dave Calhoun, a 45% pay rise after a door blew off an Alaska Airlines 737 in January. Boeing denies there's fatigue anywhere in its 787 airframes. In a statement provided to us, it said, "We are fully confident in the 787 Dreamliner because of the comprehensive work done to ensure the quality and long-term safety of the aircraft. These claims about the structural integrity of the 787 are inaccurate." The company also noted that in 13 years of service, the global 787 fleet has safely transported more than 850 million passengers on more than 4.2 million flights. And it claimed that a 787 can safely operate for at least 30 years before needing expanded airframe maintenance routines.
One way or the other, you know? Who got paid big bucks to do whatever?
I asked Cynthia Cole what happened to the company she loved.
They lost their way. They went after money and stock price and, you know, big bonuses for the managers instead of focusing on quality and safety. And this is what we always said. We focus on quality and safety and the profits will follow. If you don't have quality and safety and a product that can be trusted by the public, you know, there goes your reputation.
If you enjoyed this episode, please do rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. It was reported by me, Giles Whittell, produced by Matt Russell, with sound design by Dominic DeLaghi. The artwork was by Emma O'Neill.
Tortoise.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Senior business leaders in the UK are keen to harness AI, but there's a complex regulatory maze emerging globally. The OECD, a group of the world's richest countries, which includes the UK, has adopted a new set of principles to ensure that AI operates in a way that's safe, fair, and trustworthy. The principles are wide-ranging, but in essence, call for AI systems to be designed in a way that respects the rule of law and human rights, and says there should be transparency around their use. By embracing the core principles of responsible innovation, UK business leaders can better explore sector-specific opportunities and emerging trends without compromising on citizens' trust. Find out more at ey.ai.
Hello, I'm John Curtis.
And I'm Rachel Wolfe. This week on Trendy, the monarchy. A year after the coronation, and as King Charles returns to work, what do we think of it? And how has that changed over time?
To listen to the episode, search for Trendy on Tortoise News wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the feed to make sure you don't miss an episode.